You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot-caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, per usual, is Neil Payne. Hi, Neil.
Hey, how's it going, Chad?
And how could we replace Kate Fagan with anyone but Allison McCann? Hi, Allison.
Hey, Chad.
Allison, you are usually our sig dig bringer. This is, I think, your first full week hosting the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. I guess I did those beginning ones where we were like dipping our toes in.
Hot Takedown archives. That's a deep cut.
We'll release don't go back
those,
there.
to Hot Takedown Plus subscribers at a certain point.
All right. So on today's show, Mambas can only live for so long. Kobe Bryant is retiring and will make sense of whether now is the right time, whether he ever came as close to Jordan as he so desperately wanted, and what his legacy will be. Then we will talk about college football. There's only 1 week to go before the college football playoff committee has to decide which four teams are making it to the playoffs. There are 8 teams that have a shot. 538's resident college football expert Andrew Flowers will stop by to explain what's likely, what's impossible, and what would lead to maximum chaos, which I think is what I, as a disinterested fan, or not even fan, disinterested watcher.
I would love to see the breakdown of people who are rooting for just pure chaos in college football, regardless of the team, versus people who actually are rooting for a team.
It's like watching NASCAR for the crap.
Yeah,
right?
It really is.
And then the MLS playoffs come to an end this weekend. We'll discuss whether the system is too flawed to tell us who the best team is in the MLS. Okay, you guys ready to talk Kobe?
I'm always ready to talk Kobe.
Let's do it.
Neil, I feel like you haven't been more excited for a segment on Hot Takedown in many weeks. Kobe, I feel like, is your muse.
Yeah,
right?
He really is. He has been for a long time.
All right, so Kobe Bryant shocked the NBA world this week by announcing something everyone saw coming, that he is retiring. After 20 seasons in the league, Bryant says he just isn't up to the task anymore. To announce his retirement, he did what any self-respecting NBA player would do. He wrote a poem and published it on the Players Tribune, a website built so that athletes can talk straight to the world at large.
Is he a senior editor there yet, or is he?
I think he's always been like a deputy to Derek Jeter.
Top of the masthead.
Yeah, was it Desvin? Did you guys see this? Was it Desvin that published the masthead of the Players Tribune?
No.
It was like the most incredible all-star masthead of any journalistic organization.
I wondered if this had like edits or like.
Yeah, who edits Kobe?
Kobe.
Does Jeter edit Kobe?
Oh my God. That would be incredible.
How does the Players Tribune work?
Do you think he uses a red pen or track changes? Or does he just like write through the whole thing?
He writes
Maybe
through.
Maybe this is Jeter's poetry, actually. He was
heavily edited.
Okay, so here is the comedian Frank Caliendo performing a verse from Kobe's ode to basketball in the style of Morgan Freeman.
You gave a 6-year-old boy his Lake of Dream, and I'll always love you for it. But I can't love you obsessively for much longer. This season is all I have left to give. My heart can take the pounding. My mind can handle the grind. But my body knows it's time to say goodbye.
My mind can handle the grind. My body knows it's time to say goodbye. Guys, was Kobe as done as he thought? Is Kobe's own hot take about his own body correct?
Yeah, it seems like it. Just based on the stats, Zach Lowe had said last week in a podcast that Kobe, he called him the most damaging player in the league in terms
this
of like hurting his own team this year. And I think that's borne out by the stats. Just looking at one of the best stats they have at Basketball Reference, value over replacement player, which just measures a player's performance against the standard of, you know, some scrub that could be grabbed off, from the D League or what have you. Kobe was the 7th worst player in the NBA so far this season.
Does that mean he was one of the scrubs?
Yeah, that he was playing worse than you could have gotten if you had replaced him with one of these scrubs. And in fact, we looked at the past 3 years of Kobe's career, and he had been sort of on aggregate like around the level of the scrub, the 0.0 mark, which means you're at the scrub. So really, for a few years now, he's been hovering at that kind of sad level.
Yeah, his Carmelo projection chart is just a flat line at 0.0, basically. Had he extended into, I guess, the next two seasons, then he would have just been a...
Right, and Carmelo's 538's in-house projection system for NBA players. And so, I mean, Kobe then realized what Carmelo, the projection system, not the player, but maybe the player too, had realized before the season started, which was that it was there was no point in staying in the league aside from the tens of millions of dollars that, that he was collecting.
And Neil and I were just talking about before that we were disappointed that we did not have Carmelo, the ranking system, out earlier, and we could have maybe seen a more interesting arc of Kobe's career. And I had asked Neil, like, what would have been peak Kobe had he retired before this sort of imminent downfall?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been a lot better than his number one comp, I think, at age 37 is Sam Cassell, who was, you know, a fine player and played for many years. But I think when you're talking about Kobe, you're hoping to see Jordan, at least Kobe himself probably would be hoping to see Jordan at the top of the list. But you'd also see, you know, players of a far greater stature because he, you know, does compare, you know, pretty favorably to the best players in the history of basketball. And, you know, we can talk about that a little more also.
So, yeah. Before we get there, I just want to bring up Kirk Goldsberry, a 538 writer, wrote this week about Kobe and had a he put in two shot charts, one from this year of Kobe's shooting and one from Kobe's best year, which I believe 2005-2006.
That's right.
And the shot chart goes from blue, which is the cool, which is the worst shooting for coolest, to red, which is the hottest shooting. And Kobe's shot chart is like ice. It's like it's so terribly depressing if you grew up watching this guy be sort of the star of the league, ignoring obviously the rape accusations and whatever else. If you just think of Kobe as a player, this has been a real fall from grace, and he has had injuries and he's tried to make it back, but it was very clear that he was washed up, I think. Okay, so let's talk about the legacy though. Zach Lowe, in a column for ESPN this week, said that he was one of the 15 best ever players. Neil, that was, you know, Zach is a savvy, stats savvy guy, but do the numbers bear it out?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can kind of see what Zach was even looking at. Like when we look at a stat like win shares, he's 15th all time in that. He's 20th in PER career. That's player efficiency rating, which is another metric that people have used over the years. So just looking at those career rankings, you can totally see where he is coming from. And a lot of the other stats sort of say the ones that balance peak value more than longevity might not rank him quite as highly because he stuck around for, you know, even toward the end, he was racking up some stats. And at his peak, he probably wasn't as good as Michael Jordan. He probably wasn't as good as LeBron in LeBron's best seasons or someone like Kevin Garnett or even like, you know, Charles Barkley. But maybe he's more like a Tim Duncan where he, you know, provided really, really, really great production and did it over the course of a really long career.
Yeah, I think you're being a little nice, Neil, since you wrote the definitive once and for all Michael Jordan was way better than Kobe Bryant.
I don't know how definitive it was because it's been written by a lot of other people too.
That's true. But a year ago you had sort of looked at their performance during their peak ages 21 to 34 and you had found that Jordan surpassed Kobe in every single relevant stat. And so I guess what were the people saying that were like, Kobe does this better? And then we kind of were like, no, actually, Jordan is better in everything that we would have compared them to each other in.
Yeah, it's a little sad because, like you guys mentioned, he always did get compared to Jordan. And I think some of it is when he came to the league, it was Jordan's, I want to say, second to last season with the Bulls, we're going to forget about those Wizards years, as I clearly just did. And, you know, he was in this lineage of next Jordans, but I think he was the player that came in with the most promise, the most potential to fulfill it at a time in which the league was also, like, very much aware that Jordan was on the way out and that they needed to find the next signature superstar. They are very similar in, you know, body type, proportion. They play the same position. So it was such a natural comparison to make. And I, you know, it's so easy to play pop psychologist and try to get into Kobe's head and assign him the motivation of, oh, he was consciously trying to be Jordan over the years. But I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think one of the things that I admire most about Kobe is that he was able to transform himself over the course of his career in various different roles that he played for very different teams. He was the second banana to Shaq on those Laker teams, and yet at the same time, he was one of the best players in the NBA in that capacity. Like, who as a second banana can you think of, aside from someone like Pippen or you know, a player of that ilk, could become as the second option in an offense, even though it was a great team, could become in his own right one of the best players in the league? And he did that because, you know, he was a good defender, especially early in his career, and he was good at, you know, he could facilitate, he could make plays happen in addition to scoring. And then once Shaq left, he transformed himself into just the absolute most high usage scorer of all time. I think, I mean, his usage rate ranks right up there with Jordan, I think, on the all-time ledger. So he had at various times in his career been very different players and excelled in all of those roles.
So, okay, does that mean then that just in 20 years we're going to be trying to find the next Kobe? Like, I'm just trying to think from a fan and the narrative perspective of how we talk about sports. Is it just a matter of whoever was last? I mean, Jordan obviously is best, right? And so maybe we'll always be trying to find the next Jordan. But alternatively, are we going to be looking for a high-volume shooter that's so good that, you know, they can take over a game the way that Kobe did? And we'll try and say, is there a next Kobe?
That's kind of an interesting question. I wonder about that sometimes, because since Kobe sort of did in some ways buy into the Jordan, I'm following in his footsteps, I want to win as many rings as him and sort of emulate him in my playing style, that maybe we won't look for the next Kobe per se. Maybe we will look for the next version of another more unique player. Like, looking for the next LeBron might be is something that I've heard been said in the media and
the next Steph thereabouts. Curry, no.
And, you know, the next Steph Curry, that is an unbelievable, you know, thing to look forward to over the next few decades. But also, maybe we could just let players be who they are.
I know, I feel like we are totally diminishing Kobe by being like, well, you weren't Jordan. When I guess I'm curious, since I have not been following the NBA since Kobe's start of his career, so maybe you have, Neil, but
since Kobe Bryant and NBA courtside on N64.
But how long before, I guess Kobe started playing, did take until those comparisons like started being made? Was it not until much later in his career that, and Jordan was long gone, or in those initial, they overlapped for, you said, like one or two seasons, where those already starting to, people starting to say like, oh, Kobe could be Jordan?
Oh yeah, it was like almost instant, if I'm remembering it right. Like, especially since Kobe went out and won the dunk contest, I believe, as a rookie, and he just sort of, you know, was clearly the best player. Like, they had tried to map Jordan onto other players. There was a guy named Harold Miner who, his nickname was Baby Jordan, and he played for the Heat coming out of Southern California, and he was not good at basketball. He had everything to be the next Jordan except actually being good at basketball. So when Kobe came through this machinery that had been, you know, gearing up to try to find the next Kobe and the next Jordan and label people that way, he was the one that showed the most promise, and I think that's why it stuck the most for him. And so then by the time someone like LeBron comes along, we almost feel like we've already had the next Jordan, because that is Kobe, and then some of the pressure gets eased off subsequent generations to be their own people.
We have to move on to talk about college football in a second, but Neil, something you said just struck something with me. So what if what we're really looking for is not the emulation of the best, but the emulation of the league warping talent? So, you know, that's why I think maybe we'll be looking for the next LeBron and the next Steph Curry more than the next Kobe, because LeBron and Curry have shown us different ways that the NBA can evolve, different ways that you can work the court and work the math of the NBA to maximize a team's chance of winning. Kobe found that, but in a mold that we already knew from the Jordan era, in a way, high volume shooting guard. We're seeing with Curry a point guard who can shoot the three and drive to the paint and is so quick that defenses have to adjust and can't quite get there. And with LeBron, you see just the power, the quickness and the power that forces people to play both outside and in against them, and that opens up things on the floor. And so maybe what we're looking for is an emulation of a talent that we've never seen before, more than an emulation of the best.
Yeah, I think you nailed it with that. And there's something to be said for Kobe being one of the last of his kind in some ways of this like mid-range based player. Like in Kirk's shot chart from Kobe's 2006 season, he knocked down an amazing number of shots. Like some of his highest above average efficiency locations were in between the paint and the three-point line, and as the game has changed, you know, midway through Kobe's career, they got rid of illegal defense in the way that it had been defined, and had, you know, started defense at 3 seconds, cracked down on hand checking, made it much more of a wide open sort of drive type guard based league, and the three-pointer has just exploded in that same amount of time. So for Kobe, it might be the last of these sort of dinosaurs from a previous era of, you know, guards that would pull up and take these mid-range shots. And in that sense, he's not league warping, but he also is sort of a reminder of what the NBA used to be, still playing in the current game.
Okay, let's leave it there. Kobe has many games left to play.
A retirement tour is underway.
That athlete's now leave, so, or announced retirement so far ahead. Maybe that's
a promising
not new
career in poetry.
Oh, man. What if Obama named Kobe the poet laureate on his way out of office?
Oh,
that would be incredible. I would read that. Although it would just be Jeter from like Cyrano from the bushes. Okay, to college football. All season long, 538 has been running a model to try and divine what the college football playoff selection committee will decide come the end of the season. Decision day is nearly upon us. Only one weekend of games remains before they choose who belongs in the playoff. And there are all sorts of scenarios that could come into play. So many I can barely keep track of them, honestly. And I've been editing Andrew Flowers' column all season. Speaking of Andrew Flowers, he's here. Hi, Andrew.
Glad to be here.
Andrew, you are 538's resident college football expert. Okay, Neil, Allison, do you have as many questions as I do about how all this works?
Many questions.
Okay. So let's start with this. There are four slots.
Yep.
Is any team definitely in one of those four slots according to tens of thousands of simulations that you've run?
Well, Oklahoma looks like a good bet here. Luckily,
out of the Big 12.
Out of the Big 12, yeah. They've already wrapped up that conference title with their win last week against Oklahoma State. They have one loss. It's not a pretty loss to Texas, but otherwise they seem really strong. They have some impressive wins over Baylor and TCU in addition to that win last week. So by our model's estimation, they have a 99% chance. Basically, they're a shoe-in into the
playoff.
No
matter who else wins and loses this coming weekend, Sooners fans, you're going to, what do you call it? Not the dance. The dance is college basketball.
Let's call it the Final Four, but that has a basketball conversation too.
What would be the dance for football? Maybe nothing. The hootenanny? No, that's just Southern.
The scrum.
I like the scrum. You're going to the scrum. All right. So Oklahoma's in. We have three slots remaining. How many other teams? Seven other teams competing for those three slots, essentially?
Yes, exactly. Seven teams over three slots. And, you know, now that Oklahoma doesn't have to worry about a conference championship this week, and they'll be watching the other conference championships. And so those four games playing this weekend, we're going to be keeping a close eye on. One in particular, the Big Ten championship between Michigan State and Iowa, looks like a de facto play-in game. The winner of that seems like they're going to be in the playoff.
Okay, so can we go back to the Big 12 not having a conference championship game? Is that a good thing for the Big 12 teams? Are they more likely to make the playoff because of it, or less, or just does it depend on the season? So, like, if Oklahoma was playing, who's the number two team right now in the Big 12? Oklahoma State?
Baylor,
Oklahoma State.
Okay.
So if they were playing this weekend, would it be more likely to lead to a Big 12 team going in, or less likely?
It's hard to say, because last year was a good example why the Big 12 probably should have had a conference championship because TCU and Baylor were both left out of the college football playoff. They had really impressive one-loss seasons. So there was a lot of hand-wringing and soul-searching in the Big 12 last year.
In fact, they refused to name a champion, right? They did a co-championship thing, which even hurt more.
Right? Exactly, right? Like. So that seemed to call for a championship game. But this year, luckily, they had this one team, this sole survivor, Oklahoma, with their, you know, clearly the one-loss conference champion that really just raked through the whole slate of top teams in November.
Okay, so back to the Big Ten game then. Iowa, Michigan State. If Iowa loses, sorry, if Iowa wins, will be undefeated, and it seems likely that they'll win, as you said, de facto game, Michigan State, same thing. If Iowa loses, they are one-loss team. Why do they not make the playoffs, given that Michigan State's also a one-loss team?
It's a great question. You know, when this college football playoff was started last year, the committee's principles, one of the things they mentioned they'd wait was conference championships. So the fact that Michigan State, despite having the same number of losses as Iowa, if they beat them head-to-head and win the Big Ten, that matters for the committee. That's one reason Iowa would be out. The other reason is that there's just too many other good teams. Again, Oklahoma's already in. It looks like the winner of if it's Alabama out of the SEC, the Tide will get in.
That's like another 99% probability.
That's another essentially lock if it happens. So one loss Iowa, impressive season. But if you lose, you're probably out.
Okay.
And it's worth saying that Michigan State and even Ohio State have a lot better, like the computer power ratings that nerds like us like to look at, which have done, you know, a pretty good job of predicting teams. Like, for instance, Oklahoma was the darling of these ratings. These ratings were like in at the ground floor. They're hipsters about Oklahoma. they liked them before
they were
big.
Sooners on the Sooners.
Yeah.
That's an awful pun.
Yeah. They were there sooner than everyone else. And so Iowa just doesn't stack up as well in these ratings to the other two big Ten teams, right?
Yeah. Iowa just has played a really weak schedule. The wins that they have had, though they've been undefeated, haven't been terribly impressive. This is their first real big challenge. And if they beat the Spartans, they're in. But if they're not, it's very unlikely. It's essentially they're eliminated.
Okay, so I would be amiss to be on this podcast and not ask about my Stanford Cardinal. You guys are just skipping over them. I know they need a lot more to shake out, Andrew, but if they do win this weekend against USC in the Pac-12 championship, then what do they need to make the playoffs?
Well, they do need some help. You know, first, like you said, they got to take care of business. If they can beat USC and win the Pac-12.
Are they favored to do that, Andrew, according to that?
No. Oh. Or I would rather, no offense, Allison, I wouldn't say one team is favored or the other. It's a 51-49 probability for USC to win. Despite having four losses, yes, our model thinks they're slightly better on a neutral
super
field.
Super rude. Okay, keep
I know. I'm sorry. But, again, it's essentially a toss-up. But if Stanford does win and take care of their business, that's good. But they need help. They need Alabama or Clemson or both to lose.
And then they can sneak in that slot that's been left by one of those top line teams winning.
Exactly. That's how it would work. It's not a sure thing, but it's likely. I mean, by the way, we're taping this on a Tuesday afternoon. Tonight, Tuesday night at 7 p.m., the latest committee rankings come out. How the committee ranks Stanford versus, say, Ohio State, which will also, just like Oklahoma, not be playing this weekend. How they rank those two teams matters, because even if Stanford wins and one of those top teams we mentioned slip up, whether Stanford's locked to get in or not depends on how the committee considers Ohio State, because that's another alternative for the fourth slot.
To be a college football fan, it just feels like you're living in a hypothetical future at all times. That you're just trying. I mean, I guess it's sort of like this in the NFL, but there's so many more playoff slots. And so when you only give four playoff slots and still have each game mean so much, even more because there are fewer games, it just gets wacky to me as a non-college football fan. Is my diagnosis of this correct?
No,
that people just aren't living in the present; they're always living in the future.
It's spot on. I mean, you're essentially trying to predict the weather. It's a whole confluence of factors. It's chaotic. A lot of different permutations, to use the wonky language here, but like that's just the way it is until they expand the playoffs.
And that was one of the challenges in building our model, right? Like, not only did we have to use the FPI for predicting who will win these games in the future, which is hard enough, but in the NFL, you have this very clearly delineated set of rules of who gets to be in the playoffs. So if you knew the outcome of every game in the future, you would know who makes the playoffs. But then on top of that, there's that other layer of trying to predict what this 12-person committee of like we called it Condi Rice and a bunch of old white guys are going to say you know what they're going to think, and it's kind of a return to the roots of college football in a lot of ways, of you know the capriciousness of the polls, and that used to be a thing for many years, and then they brought in the BCS and thought that would fix it, and it ended up making things a whole lot worse, and so now they're back with this sort of halfway in between solution, I think.
Absolutely. And let's be clear here, you know, we're a numbers driven site, but college football hasn't rid itself of politics. There could still be some, you know, backroom deals and cigar smoking that go on behind here. I'll give you one example.
Stanford may still work at Stanford. Just
yes.
That's a fair point. I'll give you one example. Like, say Alabama wins, but Clemson loses to North Carolina, and this one loss, though kind of looked upon as a weak team, North Carolina, wins the ACC. Let's say Stanford loses too, no offense, Allison. Well, then who do you pick for that fourth slot? You've got Alabama, you've got Oklahoma, you've got the Big Ten winner. Do you pick UNC, the winner of the ACC, or do you pick a much more popular, a much more lucrative national team and say Ohio State, who only has one loss? They've won essentially 23 of their last 25 games. I don't know. If one team gets picked over the other, a lot of drama could ensue.
What a system.
I know. It's just, like, fascinating to me, too, because, like we were saying before, that this is, like, college sports, and as someone that played college sports, I don't know, there is, like, this, I know it is tainted a bit, but, you know, that you're playing for, like, your school and all this stuff, and I just, like, this whole wheeling and dealing makes the thing, like, feel like, I mean, these are, like, 18-year-olds playing, and I'm just like, these kids are like, you miss this one field goal this weekend, Stanford, you lose that game, you are not making the playoffs. Like, how is that kid? Mm. I don't know. It's just mind-boggling.
Our boss, Nate Silver, has this pet theory that because Ezekiel Elliott, the running back of Ohio State, after Ohio State lost a week or two ago, he spoke out and said that he should have been getting the ball more and that he was going to go pro at the end of the year. And there was this whole mm-hmm. national conversation about whether that was appropriate or not, because we have to shame young athletes for doing anything independent. And so as a result of that, Nate's theory is that the committee has looked less kindly on Ohio State, because it looks like the program is out of control or whatever sort of language you want to put to it. And this goes to your point, Allison, that these are 18 or 19-year-olds. I don't know how old Elliott is, but you know he's certainly not an experienced professional athlete, who are making decisions that somehow affect huge other things, including the money that these universities take in, which is some of the reason why so much athlete behavior is watered down in the first place, which what made the protests at University of Missouri so interesting as well. Okay. I feel like I have some sense of at least how complicated it is, if not the actual ins and outs of this. Guys, are you good?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
Okay. I need a Stanford win, and I need a
Alabama or Clemson loss.
Or both. Take all the chaos.
Yeah, then I'll get the third or
But if Alabama
spot.
And Clemson win, this is pretty much a done deal. We can go to bed early and sleep in on Sunday morning.
You're saying that because you have to write copy.
I know, I do.
I have to edit it, Andrew. All right, Andrew Flowers, thanks very much. Listeners, you can read all of Andrew's coverage of the college football playoff at 538, and keep an eye out for updates as Saturday games continue. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on. This weekend, the Portland Timbers and Columbus Crew play against one another in the MLS Cup, the final round of the Major League Soccer playoffs. It's a tight match featuring two teams with narrow goal differentials, and both teams finish second in their conferences, each with the same point totals. So let's get straight into the take, and then we're going to talk about how wacky the MLS playoffs are. Here's Steve Nichol from ESPN FC talking about why Columbus is heading for victory in Sunday's final.
I think you have to say that Columbus are the favorites because they're at home. Listen, if it was the other way around and Portland were at home,
it's as
I would have
easy
taken
as that.
There's so little to choose between the two sides, I think, that that home factor is what's going to do it for Columbus.
Okay, so can we just put a pin in whether Columbus is actually favored because they're at home and talk about why they're at home in the first place? Allison, if I understand correctly, this is not a normal thing to happen in a soccer final.
So I guess it's normal for the MLS. They've sort of been straddling this funny embracing of international soccer's home and away playoff setup and then, you know, a championship game at a neutral site. However, they also want to reward teams that do well in the regular season, which is why they've given Columbus, the higher seed, the home game for the MLS Cup. So it's a little bit of a funny scenario. Might be worth talking through. We actually got a reader email last week from Reader Wen, who had been asking us for a little bit of an explanation on the MLS playoff scenario. So I think it's worth noting that the MLS does do a home and away setup for all of the conference semifinals and finals. So that's when they, you know, play two games. And
that's a traditional soccer setup as far as tournaments.
Correct.
Go.
Yeah. And the MLS only last year even embraced the away goals rule. So in the event of a tie, away goals are worth more. So you can kind of see them moving in this direction. And then it's like, oh, wait, here we are with a essentially home game for Columbus on Sunday in the playoffs. And they are favored to win pretty heavily, I guess, 64% favorite. But interestingly enough, our ESPN Stats and Info had told us that if Portland were at home, they would be a 70% favorite to win. So Steve was correct in saying that these are two very close teams and this sort of home field advantage is becoming the deciding factor.
Is that normal in soccer for home field to be that just determining of a I mean, I guess because it's a single game and they've decided to make it this one and done for the championship that, you know, a factor like home field would play that much of a role.
So I was really curious about this going back to sort of the home and away setup because, interestingly enough, there's sort of this logic that playing the second leg at home has an advantage because you sort of know what the aggregate score is, how well you need to, you know, bunker in, whatever, whatever. But interestingly enough, both the Red Bulls and I guess FC Dallas were both the second leg home teams in the conference finals, and they both ended up not advancing to the playoffs. So that didn't work out well for them, the MLS setting up this second leg home. So I'd kind of looked into whether this was a good thing, and some researchers at the University of, I can't even pronounce this, isn't in German, somewhere in Munich, Germany, sort of looked at how this worked in the Champions League. They analyzed, I think, something like all of the UEFA Champions League matches since 1995. And turns out the team that gets the second leg home is pretty much meaningless. Only 56% win probability for having that second leg home versus not. So In this two-phase setup, it really doesn't matter. They kind of go on to say that our analysis shows there's no statistical evidence for this belief that you have a better chance of winning the series, getting the second leg home. Mm-hmm. However, we go back to the MLS playoff. You have a one-and-done game, and here I think the home field does matter. Our soccer power index says that home field advantage is worth about 0.57 goals in international soccer. So here, again, tricky. This is saying international soccer, and we're just in a domestic league. So, but I do think in a one-and-done scenario, home field is worth a lot.
And if I'm remembering right from the World Cup stuff that we did with the SPI, do they also take into account travel distance in addition to home field, or is this like after, you know, is it all lumped together, I guess?
So I think for the MLS, unfortunately, they are sort of refining how the Soccer Power Index works, which is something that Nate had worked on with ESPN many years ago, but it really is geared toward international soccer. And I think that does, like you said, do travel distance, whether you're going east to west. But here in the MLS, they say we only have a few seasons, so this doesn't actually take into account travel and things of that nature. So hopefully we'll get better sense of what home field is worth in the MLS. I mean, I guess traveling from Portland to Columbus is not insignificant. That could be like France to Russia. No, that was way further. But
not that far.
Yeah, so I don't know. I just do think it is really interesting that MLS trying to split this world and not being sure they're like appealing to American fandom of like, because there's this other argument that they're just doing the one and done game because they like, you know, it sort of waters down TV ratings when you have these two games. People are like, which one is the winning? And like, it's very anticlimactic to win a like to lose the second game but win on aggregate, then people are like confused by soccer. So I do think the MLS is having to be like, okay, we're gonna do just a
but it's the best of both worlds with neither world actually existing. Like it's like the best of both worlds, but they don't get the best. Like they're trying for the best rather.
They want a Super Bowl almost of MLS, it seems like,
but
is the rationale.
In someone's home field.
But then in someone's home field, which sort of defeats the purpose of the one and done, you know, aspect of the Super Bowl. And then also in sports you see like generally the number of games escalates as the stakes get higher in the playoffs. Like, you know, the NBA used to have a best of five for its first round and then it would be best of seven after that. You don't see ever it go downward in the number of games so that you played like a best of seven conference final and then you played like a best of three, you know, championship round or something like that. So it's kind of endlessly interesting that they are trying to really apply and mix and match aspects of the European club soccer standards and also what we as Americans have grown used to from our sports. And they're almost like picking the worst options from both in some cases.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, and I just, you know, back to your notion about the Super Bowl, in our Soccer Power Index, we had written that home field advantage is worth 2 to 3 times as much in international soccer as it is in the NFL. So that's even crazier to me that if, you know, we're saying that, you know, for some reason, having, you know, nice grass and fans and all the things and not traveling matters more in soccer than does the NFL, and yet we are giving Columbus a 3 times advantage. I mean, that's pretty crazy.
Okay, so I'm going to take it high level for a second. Like, and I think we may have talked about this on the show before. What's a playoff supposed to do? Like, what is it supposed to find the best team, or is it supposed to get a league the most TV ratings? So the flip side of what we're talking about here, and I agree this seems like a Frankenstein that like doesn't quite add up, which is a mixed metaphor. So speaking of things that don't add up. You know, we know who the best regular season team was in the MLS, and they get a cup or a shield or something.
Supporters Shield. Yeah, okay. It's even like the lamest name. Like, if you're going to try to make
that?
The regular
who wants
season.
The Supporters Shield?
Yeah, like, that's like, I don't know why they. Yeah, anyway, keep going, Chad.
So they get the Supporters Shield because they've been so supportive of the rest of the league by beating them. So, you know, the best team has already been found, if you will, in the MLS. You can say the same about many sports leagues. But in the other American sports leagues, we expect the best team to be the one that wins out in a tournament. And then we argue if they had an easy path to the finals or whatever. The flip side of this is that we're being naive to not think of these things as businesses and as corporations. And that the role of the business and corporation is to maximize profit. And the way to do that is to have really exciting playoffs, even if there's an underdog, even if the Mets all of a sudden aren't good enough but still make the World Series and they're from a big market. And you know, that drives a lot of attention because they have somewhat of a Cinderella story. And these two teams happen to be second in their conference respectively. But, you know, there's an incentive to have the unexpected happen for sports leagues. And so shouldn't, in some ways, if we want to care about the health of American soccer, am I arguing myself in circles take-wise? If we care about the health of American soccer, hot take, we should want the playoffs to be as messy and screwed up as they actually are.
Well, I don't know about messy and screwed up. Like, for instance, the most successful playoffs in American sports are the NFL playoffs, and they seem to have struck like a really good balance. Many TV viewers would disagree with you.
The Final Four would disagree with you.
But they seem to have struck a really good balance between randomness and, you know, letting the teams in that could plausibly be the best, and also having a relatively short regular season in which we don't, you know for sure who is and who isn't the true best team. And then you know, setting those teams off in a one and done format, but giving the division winners, certain division winners, buys and things like that. The NBA, you could argue, takes it too far in the direction of trying to stage an experiment that proves who is the best team, because the best team usually wins in the NBA. And
it takes 2 months for that to happen.
It takes 2 months for it to happen. The sample size is enormous, and we have a lot of confidence at the end of the NBA season as to the champion being the best team. But at the same time, was it really as entertaining as something like the NFL? And we've seen with baseball that they might take it too far in the opposite direction, where, you know, you see teams that, you know, the Mets might be an example of that, where they didn't win the championship, but they went to the World Series by beating a bunch of teams that were arguably better than them during the regular season. So then you start to wonder, well, why did we watch the regular season, the 6 months of baseball, you know, and 162 games per team? Did it even matter? That's right. And so, it's all about trying to find that fine balance, I think, between the science experiment of the best team and the entertainment factor of the randomness, but also having you feel like you didn't waste your time during the regular season. So yeah, it sounds like that kind of is what MLS is trying to go for, with the Supporters Shield winner being the team that gets some kind of advantage, in this case, the sizable home field advantage if they are in the championship game. But at the same time, there's this, you know, soccer, as we know from covering the World Cup, it's one of the more random sports in terms of, you know, the number of goals are really low, and, you know, freak bounces can swing the entire game. And then, you know, this descending number of games going to the championship just sort of reinforces that it doesn't seem to know whether it wants to increase the sample size and make it more reliable, the result, or make it just chaotic and exciting in that way.
Yeah, I'm like almost on board with everything that the MLS is doing aside from this home field championship. Like, I like the home and away setup. I think, like we talked about before, there's an argument for whether the second leg home matters. Maybe that should be a team gets to choose. You know, there's all kinds of like interesting psych things on whether you think it's better to be away or home first. So maybe that the higher seed gets to pick that. It's not just like an assigned thing. And then I'm fine with the championship being one and done. You know, that's how Champions League works as well. But it needs to be at a neutral site. There's a huge argument that this Portland and Columbus game would be a much better. They would be almost at a, you know, 50-50 odds if this was at a neutral site. So it's, you know, let's do away with this lame Supporters Shield. Let's just say, like, they won the regular season. Kudos. Like, now we're on to the playoffs. And interestingly, only 3 of 13 Supporters Shields have actually reached the MLS Cup. So we're already, like, nobody, you know.
Okay, fine. You guys have sufficiently proven me wrong. We will leave it there, and I will holster all future contrarian takes that aren't actually based in data, which is, you know, sort of the point of the show. All right, Allison, usually this is when we go retrieve you from your desk in the other room, but you're already here.
Already here, just easing right into significant digits.
It's Sig Dig time when you bring us a telling data point from the world of sports. What have you brought us?
I got more soccer, because what else do I bring to Hot Takedown than soccer? This week's is 23rd, and this is the, I guess, rank of the U.S. women's national team in the new FIFA 16 video game, the first video game to include women's teams, and they are the 23rd most played team around the world, which is, you know, seems stunning. We'll get into this a little bit more. There's 600 teams, only 12 of which are women's national teams. But, you know, they're being chosen 23rd. So
are they the most used or played women's team?
I believe so. The COO of EA Sports, I guess, was talking about this at a conference last week and sort of threw out this stat. So we've been trying to dig into it a little bit. But I would imagine that, yes, EA Sports is market for women's soccer is mostly American, but I think it's novel, but, you know, maybe not as noteworthy as we think. FIFA 16's only been out for about 2 months, so they don't have a ton of the data on the other teams, or they didn't release the other teams that are most played. So I looked at FIFA 15 and the teams that were most played, and it was basically just the best teams in the world. Mm-hmm. Barcelona, Chelsea, Real Madrid, Liverpool, Man City. So which is interesting too. I was wanted to know if the U.S. women's national team is maybe one of the most played national teams. I think when you play with the men's team, you're more likely to play with a club. But these are all sorts of questions that I have for EA Sports.
Yeah, and I wonder how much that says also about just like U.S. gamers wanting something that the U.S. is really good in, like the U.S. women's team relative to women's teams, and perhaps even, I don't know how the game mechanics work, but if they're, you know, play to their ratings against the men's teams, then, you know, they would be the best U.S. team by far. In the
Can you play cross-gender?
No, you can only play.
That seems ridiculous.
I know.
Like,
that was like
video games are about fantasy or wish fulfillment. Like, I don't know how many people wish to play women's versus men's soccer, but like,
that why seems, not let
you? Like, it's just computer code. It's not like you would offend my sensibilities. You wouldn't do that in real life either, but especially digitally, like, there's nothing to lose. That's crazy.
I think it is interesting because they did make it their own rating system for the women's league. So, like, the highest ranked female is Carly Lloyd. She has a ranking of 91. The highest ranked male is Messi with a ranking of 94, Ronaldo 93. So, like,
so we might see that Carly Lloyd might possibly be as good as Ronaldo.
Yeah,
that would
like,
be too much.
Can we?
God forbid.
Yeah.
But I don't know what a 91 means in the women's versus a 93, so maybe FIFA 17 will get to mixed genders. Who knows?
EA Sports workers who are listening, let us know the full rankings. We're interested.
The Donnie Moore of soccer.
All right. Thanks, Allison, for doing Sig Dig. And now I have to thank you again for doing the show. Thanks, Allison.
Keep them coming. Thanks for having me.
Neil, thank you as ever.
Aw, thanks, Chad.
All right. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast czar is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We get production assistance from Jordan Shulkin and Lois St. Jacques. We have no intern this week. Sarah Patterson, we miss you. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, or all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.